Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabuke. And this week, we talk about Goldilocks and the Bears. But we also talk about, we sort of touch base on a couple of things that we had touched on in the last couple of weeks. We talk about spies. We talk about the Baltimore Sun and just Baltimore news in general. We touch in on Afghanistan and bomb plots here at home. I would say, Mike, this is just kind of a nice little even segmented chunk by chunk, you know, marching through the news. And there were some hot takes, there were some lukewarm takes, and then there was some lack of pith.
Yeah, we had both pith and lack of pith in this one. It was a good all piths matter kind of episode. Fun to also get kind of a little more personal and talk about some of our own decision making as parents around schools and the Delta variant and how we're thinking about it and what we're hearing across the news as well.
Yeah, I hope everyone enjoys it. And what do you say, Mike?
Let's get into it. Welcome, everyone. Good to see you, Errol.
Good to see you, Mike. How's it going? Just going to open my beer here real quick. Is that all right? News and Brews?
Sound effects. Let's do it.
Yes. How's it going, man?
It's going well. You know, I was out of town over the weekend at a family reunion that was planned before the Delta variant was a thing. And so that was, you know, slightly harrowing at times, but also like really nice. You know, I sort of got to connect with a couple degrees away from the family members I usually see and connect with some people like in my generation who I either didn't know or had only met once or twice. It was really cool.
Where was it?
Indiana.
That's not close to here at all.
Yeah, no, my mom's from Indianapolis.
Oh, no kidding. Your mom is famous on News and Brews too. I didn't know that she was from Indianapolis.
That's right.
So you took one of those airplane things to get out there.
I did. And I had, I had my KN95 and, you know, it was okay. I ended up with my own row, at least going there, which was nice. But overall, I think from what I've heard, at least airplanes are not the highest risk location because the recirculation of the air actually includes purifying of it and filtering of it. When I had to go on flights, you know, in the pre-vaccine era and when there was just less known in general, I felt much more nervous than I did this time.
I think it's probably better than like a basement dingy Adams Morgan club. I'm going to go with plane is better than that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think under what circumstances I would end up there. I don't know if that's a binary choice for me at this point in life.
That's fair. There was like a pop-up. I think it was Peruvian or Bolivian alcohol bar situation on 18th Street a few weeks ago. And it was in this basement of a skate shop that is also vegan and sells sandwiches. Very kind of eclectic DC.
I was going to say, aren't all skate shops vegan?
I don't know. I don't know if that's a thing.
Well, if they're not like, if they're selling skateboards and stuff.
That's true. I don't think it was the skateboards that were vegan. I think it was like the Associated Sandwich Shop. In any case, they're in their basement. They had this pop-up and Lauren and I were like, yeah, we should do that. We should go. We should get a babysitter and we should try this new pop-up fancy little cocktail place. I don't think it's there anymore and we didn't end up going. So that's just to hammer home the point that you were making about non-binary choices.
Is that because you were getting concerned about the resurgence of the Delta variant, or is that because you are parents of young children and that's just kind of how things work?
I think it was technically we just never got our shit together. Mm-hmm. But let's go with Delta.
Nice. Very, very prudent. Make good choices, kids.
Yeah, exactly. What are you drinking tonight, Mike?
I am drinking tonight a Ghost of the James American Pale Ale from Three Notched Brewing Company in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I'll tell you something about this beer. Drinking it, it's like a luscious velour sprinkled with rose petals and apricots, but for your throat.
I'm not sure I want a luscious velour on my throat, but
that's the thing. That's what I'm, you know, pushing our listeners to ask themselves right now.
It's like you don't know that you want it until Mike tells you that you want it. Ghost of the James. I think that's like a really great name. I kind of want to know the story, but then I kind of don't. I just want to make up the story.
They don't print it on the can, from what I can see.
Doesn't that same brewery do a spicy Belgian something or other?
I don't know.
Anyways, I always see the can and I'm like a little terrified of the can, so I never buy it. But Charlottesville's a beautiful place. I'm sure it's great
beer. It's true.
Luscious velour of a beer. So I've actually got a German beer tonight, as German as one can get at the local Harris Theater. it's a Tuscher Helles Hefeweizen. So most people know what a Hefeweizen is. I have no idea what a Tuscher Helles is, but it's a very German beer. It's so German, in fact, that it claims to be naturally unfiltered in accordance with the Bavarian purity law, which of course I then Googled.
Right. That's something you have to be really careful about throwing around, is the history of purity laws in Germany is, let's say, checkered.
Loaded. Yeah, for sure. Well, this one has apparently nothing to do with where you were going with this. It was written by a Bavarian nobleman in the year 1516. I'm not good at math, but I think that was 500 years ago. And the law says that only water, barley, and hops may be used to brew beer. And apparently, because that was probably disgusting, they added yeast later on to the list.
No apricots and rose petals on their velour.
No, this is definitely not a velour. It's like a very refreshing summer beer, but I'm not getting the velour. Mm-hmm. I need to like write a strongly worded letter to this brewery and I'd say, I just need a little bit more velour in my life. Should we get going with the first round?
Let's do it. We'll start with some follow-ups to stories we've covered recently. So first up, during last week's coverage of Errol's trip to the Spy Museum, which I think it's safe to say was the Jason Bourne movie of podcasts that we did
100%,
last week. 100%. We talked about Josephine Baker as one of the most successful female spies in history. On Sunday, an advisor to French President Emmanuel Macron announced that Baker will be honored with the highest posthumous honor France can bestow, a burial in the Panthéon, alongside other heroes of French history like Voltaire, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Victor Hugo, and Marie Curie.
I like how you gave Pantheon like a little bit of je ne sais quoi there.
I hope it was obvious that I have no idea how to pronounce that in French. it is spelled like Pantheon, but I did the Google Translate search and hit the French pronunciation and couldn't even get close.
Pantheon. No, that's Spanish. Keep going.
Baker will be one of very few foreign-born recipients of this honor and the very first Black woman. And I think we should mention a little bit about her bio here, because the spy activities we talked about during World War II last week were really just a footnote in her biography. And you know, she came up through vaudeville, the Harlem Renaissance, and Broadway, ultimately, before she moved to Paris in 1925 and really got her big break out there, became a massive global star. In addition to her espionage work with the French resistance during World War II, she also then became a major figure in the civil rights movement in the US in the 50s and 60s, speaking at the March on Washington. And she even adopted 12 children from like all over the world.
Because she wasn't busy enough,
apparently. Right. With this latest news, several news outlets have reported the decision to honor Baker comes amid a fraught political context with rampant culture wars in France and tensions between the government and universities over freedom of expression. It also comes as a response to a petition that received over 40,000 signatures organized by the French writer, for getting back to my French pronunciation, Laurent Kupferman, who said that Baker deserved the honor because, quote, Josephine Baker embodies the republic of possibilities. How could a woman who came from a discriminated and very poor background achieve her destiny and become a world star? That was possible in France at a time when it was not in the United States, end quote. And I think that's really powerful. It does, though, of course, obscure the real reason Baker received the honor this week, which, Errol, as you know, is the news and bruise bump.
Has to be the news and bruise bump. Well said, Laurent. And I think it's not something that we talk about enough in this country. I was actually listening to a podcast this week about Jesse Owens, the original track goat, and his sojourn to the 1936 Berlin Olympics, and how he was this just incredible star, but he was not able to travel over in the same cabin as the other white athletes. He was, however, in Germany during Nazi led Germany, able to stay in a hotel with the other white athletes. But then when he returned home, he had to like enter the, you know, all the hall, like he was being honored and feted across the country, but he would always have to enter through separate entrances to whatever hall he was going into. And I believe it was Roosevelt at the time didn't even call him to congratulate him.
Wow.
And it was, yeah. So he, I think justifiably had a lot of anger over that. And it just goes to show, I mean, this was sort of right before World War II. And I think throughout World War II, what Josephine Baker had to deal with here is probably pretty similar. And she, as our friend Laurent said, it was possible to do that in France at a time when it was not in the United States.
Mm-hmm. As an extension, because I've got a random podcast to plug as well. I don't think we're doing a big follow-up on what's happening in Haiti this week. We should return to it next week because devastation from the earthquake and the tropical storm there in the wake of the assassination of the president is still unfolding. They still need a lot of help. But I came across this podcast called Revolutions. It's by Mike Duncan, who's a historian. And he does a whole season on the Haiti Revolution.
Ooh.
So and it basically unfolds like a series, almost like a series of like college lectures. And so really interesting and informative and just provides a ton of context to all of the news that we sort of seem to hear on a recurring basis coming out of Haiti.
Very cool. I'll add that like right after my next pop culture podcast, which of course me saying that is the tell that I don't actually listen to any pop culture podcasts because I have no idea what the names of the coolest podcasts are.
You were reaching for one.
I was thinking of one and I was like, I got nothing.
Another follow-up, this time to our interview last month with Dr. Nikki Usher about her book, News for the Rich, White, and Blue. In that conversation, we talked about Baltimore and the Baltimore Sun specifically as an example of the Goldilocks newspapers, which is a term that Nikki coined, which are the papers most threatened by the shifting landscape for news production and consumption. She calls them Goldilocks because they're big enough to represent large metro areas, but not big enough to draw a national audience.
They're just right.
Right. But as I was thinking about this, another good reason to call them Goldilocks is that they face really the same power dynamics as a small child confronting three huge bears. Side note, do you remember how the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears ends?
She outwits them?
No. So I, like, for the life of me, could not remember how this story ended. Like, everyone knows kind of the setup and, like, the, you know, this is too hot, this is too cold, this is just right, yeah, et cetera. Yeah, yeah. But I could not, for the life of me, recollect how it ends. And so I looked it up. And first of all, as with many like fairy tales or nursery rhymes, like it's just got like a really weird history. And like in the original version, there was no adorable small child involved. It was like an old woman who was like described as like overtly off-putting, basically. And she basically, when the bears realized she was there, she just kind of like yelled at them and jumped out the window and was never seen heard from again. And that was the end of it.
In the original?
That's in how the original. And I think as it evolved, basically, it's almost like when a song just like fades out. Like there's like no good ending. I think Goldilocks technically like runs away and gets away, but like that's not realistic. So a lot of people have speculated for a long time that that was meant to be like a euphemism for her getting eaten by the bears. But I think that was sort of just how the story evolved.
Or like change for the kids.
Right.
It just reminds me of like all the... like all these kid songs that have either had the words changed because they were super racist or like, you know, Ring Around the Posy was actually about Black Death.
So that, according to Wikipedia, is a myth.
Oh, well, I believe it. So it has to be true.
Yeah, because there's a lot of chatter about it, you know, during the
ashes initial ashes, early
pandemic. Yeah, those words. So highly recommend the Wikipedia entry for Ring Around the Rosie because it's very informative and extensive. But like those words that we know, like ashes, was basically like I don't know what the term is, but it sounded sort of like the original words that were either in like Old English or German or something. Like it actually has no meaning of its own.
This strikes me as something that the Ring Around the Rosy lobby wants you to believe. We and could paid be somebody.
It's true. I could be an unwitting patsy here for big Ring Around the Rosy.
Yeah, you're spreading misinformation. It's not me that's spreading misinformation. It's you.
Mike. One of us is spreading misinformation. We know that for sure.
We'll leave it up to the listeners to decide.
We report, you decide. Getting back to our story. So in the case of Baltimore, we might have a way for Goldilocks to outrun the Bears. There were job postings that showed up on the website Jubal indicating that a new nonprofit news organization backed by Stuart Bainum, who, if you remember, is the chairman of Choice Hotels based in Maryland, who was trying to buy the Sun before it ultimately sold to the hedge fund / chop shop Alden. Yep. He and Michael Bloomberg are backing this new nonprofit and hiring for several roles. And according to the postings, this is a quote, solely focused on the Baltimore area, they are creating a new paradigm for digital first cross-channel local media. Their content will extend across web, mobile, radio, and video. Their vision is to be the leading provider of news and lifestyle content in the Baltimore area. End quote. So we wish them well. And yeah, I think if there's any billionaire out there who can run a news organization, it's probably Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, I would hope so.
He's got connections to Baltimore too. He went to Hopkins and his name is on their School of Public Health. He like donated $150 million to them earlier this year. So good connections there. Some hopeful news.
So wait, are they going to call it the Baltimore Sun?
I mean, because this will be totally separate from the Sun, which is now owned by this hedge fund.
Okay, so they're not trying to like buy the Sun from the hedge fund.
They're no longer trying to buy the Sun. That sale has been, at least as far as I know, that sale has been completed and is a done deal.
So what should they call it? The Baltimore Moon?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that they list all these media they'll be covering, web, mobile, radio, video, not newspaper.
Yeah. No. I noticed that. That was conspicuous in its absence.
Yeah.
Maybe we like trees and we don't want to cut them down anymore. I don't know. I got nothing. Print media is dead is maybe the answer. All right, Mike. Well, we've gone through the Josephine Baker spy story and the Goldilocks interview with Nikki Usher, and those were really excellent follow-ups. And I agree that we should do Haiti at some point because I think that's a continually unfolding tragedy. The whole story just kind of accentuates the limits of assistance, foreign assistance, humanitarian assistance, and our ability to sort of create governments and stuff like that. So before I go into that rabbit hole, I will just put that off to another day. So, Mike, a last follow-up for today is to check in on things in Afghanistan. And unlike your Goldilocks story and the story about Josephine Baker, I have nothing pithy. I have no pith. The update is basically that evacuations seem to be proceeding. They had a slow, many people would say terrible start. But as of recording, President Biden has said that they've gotten over 70,000 people out, which is pretty remarkable. You know, even if it was a slow and terrible start, it's pretty remarkable to get 70.
Yeah, what has it been, like 10 days?
It has been less than 10 days. And when they first announced that they were going to try to get 50,000 people out, everybody was like, no, you can't do that. It's not going to happen by August 31st. And so, I mean, you can harp on the limits of American exceptionalism all you want, but I think that there's something to be said for when the U.S. military and State Department and other kind of organs come into play in a big way. They know how to get shit done. And so I think it's a drop in the bucket in terms of the people who I'm guessing would like to leave Afghanistan, but it's certainly something. And the issue is, Mike, that looking forward a little bit, the Taliban and the U.S. have sort of tacitly agreed that the Taliban would give a window, quote unquote, until August 31st to let people out. And that was the day that we were planning to kind of end all combat operations and get our people out anyways, months ago. I mean, this is something that's been talked about for a while. And Joe Biden said that we're going to stick to that. So we've had about 6,000 troops on the ground trying to get people out. And he basically, they've already started drawing down, and the evacuations are going to stop, and we will have very few, if any, eyes and ears on the ground anymore. Needless to say, Congress is not happy about this situation in a bipartisan way. There was a press conference with a bipartisan group of House representatives members, and they were really not happy about that. I think that this is going to be something that evolves over the next week, and we'll certainly be watching it. I just wanted to say one thing about, like, I feel like when we talk about Afghanistan and people leaving, I mean, there's been some really harrowing images coming out, you know, people trying to get on planes as they're going down the runway, and a lot of really, you know, harrowing, terrible things. I read a Post article today that was shared by a colleague that was written by Susanna George, who I believe was the Afghanistan desk chief for the Washington Post. She wrote of this very sort of first person personal account of what it took to get her and her Afghan colleagues and their families, not just out of the country, but to the airport from where they were staying. I mean, harrowing is the only word I can think of to describe what this was like for this person, and also primarily for the Afghans and their families.
Yeah, the Post has done a really nice job, I think, capturing some like individual human stories around this. I read another article about an immigrant from Afghanistan who was able to move to the US a few years back because he had worked in the embassy for 5 or 10 years and earned that and brought his family over with him. Ultimately, he's got a wife and 5 kids. And last month, they decided to make one last trip to Afghanistan to see their families and, you know, have that last touch point, knowing that the withdrawal was coming, knowing that the future was uncertain and their ability to visit the future may no longer exist. And ultimately, given the speed of everything, you know, he was getting the same intelligence reports from, you know, filtered through friends at the embassy that everyone else was, thinking that this would take much longer. Ultimately, he was able to come back, but his family is still over there. And so the story was about him, you know, talking to them every day through their phones and hearing their stories of not being able to get even close enough to the airport to show anyone who would possibly care their green cards. Yeah. And just that situation, I think, for Afghans on the ground is becoming more hopeless with time.
Yeah. I think the Taliban is trying to put forth this face to the world of like, oh, we're maybe not as bad as everybody thinks we are. I think they're just as bad as everybody thinks they are. And I'm really, really worried again, like I said, after this August 31st deadline, when there's no more US troops. And quite frankly, there was a G7 today meeting today, Mike, where, you know, leaders of the 7 biggest economies got together and they were basically pleading with Joe Biden, like, don't send your troops home, you know, extend the deadline past October 31st. And he essentially said no. And which means that they're all going to have to leave too. So it's not just our eyes and ears on the ground. It's everybody's eyes and ears on the ground. And I think folks like that gentleman's family are really up a creek without a paddle. The Taliban are probably going to be fairly punitive in their response to governance. And I don't think they're going to have a whole lot of time for like, oh, I have a green card, I need to get out. I think that window is closing. And so I definitely feel for those folks. And I think once we get past this initial kind of like, okay, we got our friends and allies and US citizens and other things out, like, let's not lose sight of the people like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'll just say, I think your first point about a lack of pith on this is actually a really good thing. Like, the problem with takes is we're still in the middle of this. Like, this history is being written every day. You know, there have been a lot of people on both sides who have rushed to sort of pass a verdict on how Biden's handling this one way or another. And it's everything is still a question mark, ultimately, in how this plays out and how this will be perceived by history. And the one point that I was planning to make on this as I was getting ready for this conversation is that we need a full accounting, right? A full accounting by the government of what happened in Afghanistan, how we got to this point, including an assessment of the withdrawal and the airlift when it's all said and done. Little did I know, have you heard of something called the Afghanistan Papers?
Yeah.
So I had not. And, you know, I think I'm obviously not following foreign affairs day to day in the same way, or at least wasn't in December of 2019 when this came out. There was a series of 6 articles in the Washington Post and a book accompanying it from a Post reporter named Craig Whitlock that was based on thousands of pages of documents obtained through FOIA that came from a federal investigation and assessment of what had happened in Afghanistan, including really frank interviews with like 400 some odd people within the US government that exposed things like the fact that the military had been lying to the public for years about our prospects and progress in Afghanistan. They knew the war wasn't winnable. They knew that there were fatal flaws in our strategy from a very early day, and that was not communicated to the public. And I was trying to figure out, like, why wasn't this a bigger deal? You know, I would guess that if I asked 9 out of 10 Americans who don't work at major DC think tanks, that most people would not know about this.
You mentioned December. Was it like Christmas or something?
It was December 9th, 2019. I looked back at like all the CNN articles that came out that day. It was the first day of the first impeachment trial of Trump. And so the Washington Post,
Craig, like, was like, damn it,
dumped all this news about Afghanistan on this day when nobody was paying attention to it.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it's really good in that it is really well researched. We talked with Nikki weeks ago about kind of the investigative journalism and that being a really critical part of our of what local news can provide and what just sort of generally the news media can provide. And I think this is a prime example of that. It's worth pointing out, Mike, if you want to dive deeper on this, SIGAR, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction, has a series of reports, one of which just came out coincidentally, that really details the sort of money that was spent and lost and squandered and sort of our efforts. And it's, you know, I think that Craig Whitlock at the Washington Post did some great investigative journalism. I think, you know, that's a really important part of our system and the checks and balances. I also think our own government has like a pretty solid accounting of everything that goes on. I think the issue with that is it's very dense and it's very long and it's very detailed. And so you almost need folks like Craig to kind of translate it and pull out the big points. Because I agree with you that I think after 2 decades, we should learn some lessons from this about what we should be doing and what we should not be doing and the limits of what we can do and things like that. So, and including the evacuation, as you said.
Yeah, I'll put in another small plug. The podcast is called Now and Then. It's hosted by Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman. They dive deep this week on the history of America in wars, you know, how America has approached wars and positioned them in public communication and justification and overall kind of national ethos over the last 250 years or so. Really interesting and provides just some interesting context on how the conflict in Afghanistan has evolved in the public imagination. We talked about this a bit last week, where there have been numerous times when significant majorities of the public and both parties were supportive of this effort. And over time, you know, I think that consensus has certainly shifted. Highly recommend for just some historical context from the American perspective.
That's great. Speaking of the American perspective, let's talk about a hyper-local thing that happened here this last week. I don't know if you get emails from your employers, I think, multiple employers, about what's going on in DC, but I certainly got an email being like, I would avoid the Capitol. It turns out that there was a bomb threat by a guy who had pulled up his pickup truck next to one of the U.S. Capitol office buildings. And
yep.
Like any good would-be assassin, he was identified in the news by all 3 of his names. So Floyd, Ray, Roseberry.
I will say, very common for high-profile criminals to have 3 names. Not common for those 3 names to sound like a Hogwarts professor. So you have to appreciate that.
Yeah. But like Hogwarts professor of not the dark arts. Like of herbology or something. apparently this guy, I don't want to make too light of this situation, but apparently Mr. Roseberry wanted to talk to President Biden. So he drove to the Capitol, which was, I think, the first mistake. Unfortunately, this all ended well. We should just And with the spoiler alert that he didn't actually have a bomb. He had explosive making materials, but he didn't actually have a bomb. Hmm. Did you see this happening this week? Did
it affect your life? Definitely saw it. I don't tend to spend a whole lot of time in that part of the city, you know, on a day-to-day basis. Obviously I have friends who do. And so I was watching it pretty closely. And, you know, I actually have a good friend who works at the Library of Congress. So I was checking in with him as it was reported to have been centered at the Library of Congress, but ultimately affected sort of the whole Capitol area and complex.
It was just kind of a mess. We were actually in the midst of refinancing our house, believe it or not. And we saw it on like the television in the finance place. And they were, we all kind of looked at it. We're like, oh, yeah, I guess we shouldn't go anywhere near there anytime soon. And it was just like, looking back on that reaction, it's just like a little bit of numbness that I wonder how much of that is because we are numb to things like that in DC. And it's worth pointing out, I don't know if you saw this part of the story, but apparently there were some students who walked by, and they were UW-Madison students that were studying in DC, and they walked by and saw this guy before any police were on the scene, and maybe even talked to him or something. And then the guy started throwing like dollar bills into the street, and it was very strange. And one of the students who was a senior said, he was quoted as saying, I don't know what's normal for DC. Senior Sydney Bob said, I would imagine the capital of the country is like the center for a lot of crazy things to happen.
that's not the worst take.
It's a great take. To Sydney, if he's listening, yes, and yes, and yes. it's worth pointing out that we reached out to Enrique Tarrio, the Proud Boys leader, recently sentenced to 5 months in jail for burning a Black Lives Matter flag even before he participated in the violent insurrection on January 6th. And he said, yeah, I'm just kidding. We didn't reach out to him, and I really could care less what that idiot has to say.
Yeah, hopefully whatever he said was behind bars.
Yeah, who cares? However, it does lead us to one thing that was announced was that the Capitol Police are fully mobilizing for a rally that is supposed to be happening on the west side of the Capitol on September 18th. So, you know, listeners, mark your calendars for the next News and Brews. I haven't thought that far ahead of my life, so I don't know what day that will come out, but there's supposed to be a rally in support of the violent insurrectionists of January 6th. So Enrique Tarrio won't be there because he'll be in jail, but there will be a whole bunch of other idiots roaming the streets.
Sometimes this whole free speech thing is just very inconvenient, Errol.
I like free speech. I just don't want them to like do violent insurrections as a result of the free speech. Mm-hmm. Speaking of free speech, it's worth mentioning that this three named Hogwarts professor and would-be bomber was like live streaming a lot of this, and social media companies eventually did take down his live stream, which may be a lesson that they've learned from things like Christchurch.
Yeah. I mean, when you say eventually though, that's fraught.
I don't know what the timing was.
Cause they eventually took down the Christchurch one too, but not before hundreds of millions of people had seen it. And, you know, it was left up for way too long.
Yeah, I think there were significant views on Twitter, and I don't know if it was on Facebook too, but it was not after some, you know, he had spouted some incoherent babble by then or something. I wanted to just talk about one more thing, actually, Mike, before we want to talk about back to school, which is both very near and dear to our hearts. We've had this penchant to end the first round with like a little bit of a good news story. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to talk about mRNA for HIV, which is like a lot of letters. And so we should brainstorm anagrams over the course of the segment.
But yeah, I might have done that. mRNA for HIV, take out the four. mRNA HIV can be arranged to, hi, Mr. Van.
Of course you did. yeah, so basically, hi, Mr. Van, is a big possibility, essentially, that this technology that Moderna and Pfizer use to develop the COVID-19 vaccine can actually is a technology that can be adapted to things like HIV and more things. I mean, this is essentially, So the director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Harvard Medical School said, the vaccine field has been forever transformed and forever advanced because of COVID-19. Mm. And it's, you know, it's hard to say positive things about COVID-19 after having killed millions of people around the world, but this could lead to more diseases, getting more vaccines, less time to develop those vaccines and sort of making them cheaper.
To my knowledge, we had never been able to get the 5G receivers into the vaccines before this, right?
Yeah, we hadn't. That nanotechnology didn't exist until Jeff Bezos went to space.
Modern marvels.
I just finished watching some of the Superman movies, and so I'm just picturing like Jeff Bezos going to Krypton and coming back with like the technology. Yeah, let's get to the main story of the day. You know, Mike, as we mentioned before, we both have kids, two of them.
Yeah, in fact. And most relevant, we both have kids who are about to start pre-K-4 here in DC.
Yes. So fun fact about pre-K-4, which of course, Mike, you know, but for the listeners, preschool is actually free in DC, which is not the case in a lot of places.
Not yet.
Around this country. Not yet. AOC is on the case. But you were not guaranteed a spot in your local school, which is why my now 4-year-old, then 3-year-old didn't get into a suitable school or a close enough school, I should say, for pre-K-3. But for pre-K-4, she actually did get into the school that literally I can throw a baseball from my front porch and hit the entrance to the school, which of course I would not do because that would be bad and I might hit some kids. But she's going to be in public preschool.
Yeah, as will ours. And he's super excited. It's kind of fun.
So he's excited. I think my daughter is excited / terrified / having big feelings that she doesn't know what to do with. Mm-hmm. But I mean, speaking of big feelings, I mean, her mom and I have been talking a lot about, we're really excited about back to school. And we're really excited that they're going to be going in person, but also kind of terrified ourselves. is that like the place that y'all are into?
Certainly, like there's a lot to think about, right, with the Delta variant and with the world we're in. And I think this being a situation that a lot of us thought we would be past by now. And, you know, it's tough. Fortunately, being in DC, we know that there will be mask mandates and hopefully a more solid vaccine mandate for faculty and staff.
Is there a vaccine mandate?
There is a vaccine or regular testing mandate right now.
Okay, which is sort of a de facto mandate because like nobody wants to get tested like that often.
Well, it's not really. I mean, you know, the more exemptions you can take out of those mandates, which I think is more reasonable to do after the full approval of the Pfizer vaccine
by the
FDA.
Which is another thing that happened in the news this week.
It did, which is great.
Do you think the approval of this vaccine will result in DC actually adopting some mask mandates across the public school system?
I know there is pressure on them to do that. You know, ultimately what Mayor Bowser and the other decision makers at the Department of Health and DCPS and OSSE, which is the State Superintendent of Education, decide. I don't have a whole lot of insight into that, but I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this kind of plays into our thinking a little bit too, where, you know, there's some variation of widespread usage of masks, not just mandating, but actually like enforcement, like let's all have masks, let's use them, vaccination of faculty and staff, and better air infiltration.
Which they've also done pretty much every school. And I know that they certainly have the resources to do it because of the relief bills that have been passed and the money that's been allocated to schools in several of those bills.
Which, let's be real, they probably were long overdue for a ventilation and filtration update in public schools. So hopefully that's good. You know, our fear is slightly less because of those things. But at the same time, you have Delta, which is much more contagious. And I think, you know, school has started in a lot of places in the country, especially in places where there's not mask mandates. I mean, there are outbreaks. And
yep.
And I think, you know, this is something that we're probably going to have to deal with as well. This is now the for a lot of kids, this is the third, successive school year where they're having to think about mask mandates and COVID and all this stuff and sort of no end in sight. And so, you know, I hope that we're not stuck at home with our kids trying to work for their sake in addition to ours. But I do fear that, you know, as Delta and whatever comes after Delta is of the more contagious variety, that we're still in this paradigm, probably justifiably so, whereby when someone tests positive, they have to quarantine and they have to stay away.
Yeah. I think the scary thing about Delta is just the unknown, right? Yeah. It was clear with the COVID classic that it was much, much less harmful to children than to older individuals. And we're seeing now with Delta that there has been an increase in both hospitalizations, serious illnesses, as well as death among children. And that's obviously terrifying for any parent. What's not clear is that increase just, basically, is it the numerator or the denominator, right? Mm. Is that increase just because there is more spread overall and, you know, it's slightly more contagious? And so you're seeing the total number of exposures to the disease going up. So naturally all these other effects of it go up too. Or is it the numerator? Is it actually a higher percentage of those cases among children resulting in serious illness or worse? And nobody knows yet because we've only been really in this Delta world for about a month now.
Yeah. And since we're all vaccine experts, in addition to Afghanistan experts on Twitter and on the pods. Yeah. I mean, I would agree with you on that. And I think that there's this fear that Delta has some sort of different effect. Again, we don't have the data, but there is a fear that it has a different effect. But I wonder how much of it is just, it's just more contagious. And so for those that get infected, are more of them ending up in the hospital? I don't know the answer to that question. But even so, it's still way lower than the population. And it's worth mentioning that, like, we probably would be in some sort of COVID situation if people, you know, got fully vaccinated, but we would not be in the situation that we're in now if more people had gotten vaccinated when they could. And we were all talking about, like, you know, oh, 90% of the population is vaccinated and now we need to think about boosters and stuff like that. But that's not where we are in a lot of places in the country. And so there will be COVID scares at our kids' schools in DC, but I think I'm really glad we don't live in Texas or Georgia or someplace like that.
You're telling me. The choices that parents in those states have to make are just not fair and not necessary and honestly horrifying.
Yeah. I wonder if there's going to be like a reverse exodus, whatever the opposite of exodus was. Like, people left New York and DC to go to these like other places and kind of settle during COVID. Like, I wonder if they're going to be like, oh, wait, but I have to put my kid in school where they're like making fun of her for wearing a mask.
I mean, I wonder if parents aren't just podding up, you know, like we saw a lot of folks do when schools were shut down and everything was virtual, just to get their kids into a somewhat safe, somewhat constructive learning environment.
Yeah. I think the good news for our kids being 4 years old is that they're still, I mean, it's a very formative, important time in their lives, but I feel like educationally, I think they'll be fine. They're still very much in a sort of play-based curriculum. And I think there's countries around the world that don't even incorporate any sort of learning until the kids are like six and older anyways. And so let's just go with that. If the Australians and like the Danes are doing it, it's got to be fine, right?
Yeah, there have been a couple of good podcasts that dove deep on this week. The Daily did a good episode a couple of days ago. And then Pivot, Kara Swisher had as a co-host guest this week, her brother, who's a doctor, and they went deep on it. And between the two, I think this was on The Daily, there was some really good advice for parents who are making these decisions, which is to start by figuring out what your top priorities really are. Right? Are you really of the mindset that, you know, the most important thing is preventing your children from being exposed to the virus? If that's the case, then you probably need to think about some pretty extreme measures. Is it that you are more concerned about, you know, other family members who may either be in your home or nearby, In which case there are other measures you can take, you know, about what you do with your kids once they get home, your testing regimes, things like that, you know, or just really starting from what your needs as a family and as a parent and as children are, and then kind of building your decisions around that.
Yeah, I think that's really wise. And I did listen to that daily episode, and I would commend it on everyone. You know, I was sort of thinking about what my answer would be. And obviously I'd have to talk to my spouse because we don't make decisions like this unilaterally. But since it's my podcast and not hers, yeah, my initial gut is just,
a couple weeks ago, we had a test to see if my wife Brie was listening. This time it's a test to see if your wife Lauren is listening.
100% she is not.
let's lay it all out there.
100% she is not. But I think she would probably agree with me on this, that, you know, at the beginning of COVID, we kept the kids home like a lot of people did for several months. And I could just see kind of a lack of energy building over time. And I remember that, I very distinctly remember that first week that she was back, and even the first couple of days when she was back in-person learning, or even daycare, I think it was. And just back with friends and teachers, and like, she loves her parents, but not her parents. She just came alive. And I think we hadn't realized the degree to which she was declining, you know, over the course of being at home. And again, she was healthy. She was fine. She was learning. It was like fine, but at the same time, not fine. And so I'm really hoping that we can avoid that situation again.
Yep. One final thought. Does the term ivermectin mean anything to you?
No.
So this was another story.
Sounds like a name of a drug.
From this past week. So it sort of is. It is a drug intended for treating worms in livestock, but there were some viral videos and other misinformation on the internet that suggested that it might be an effective treatment for COVID, particularly in Mississippi. You've basically had people kind of raiding the farm supply stores.
No.
And poisoning themselves with this drug. And so at least 70% of the calls into the statewide health alert network in Mississippi have been related to people ingesting this ivermectin purchased at livestock supply centers because they don't want to take the vaccine.
That's scary. Donald Trump's not even in the White House to talk about household cleaner, and that's still like a thing.
The other thing that happened this week is Donald Trump got booed for talking about the vaccine in a positive way at his rally. Did you see that?
I did not see that.
So this, it's like, you know, at first it was like the quote unquote smart conservatives, right? Were kind of squeezing the toothpaste of Donald Trump out and then couldn't put him back in.
Yeah.
Now Trump has lost control. Like he's out there talking about the vaccine that he got developed and getting booed for it.
Oh, interesting. To be honest, I didn't even know he had a rally. And that makes me very happy that I didn't even know that he had a rally. Yeah. Listen, Mike, I think we did a much better job this week of fixing it. What do you think?
We fixed it.
I think we totally fixed it.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
See you next week.
News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Tuesday, August 24th, 2021 at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Tuesday, August 10th, 2021 at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.